Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 207 of CJ Evolution. 207 episodes because of you, the listener and supporter. Patrick here. I'm the host and creator of this great show we call CJ Evolution. This is a podcast for the criminal justice professional out there who's listening, but it's also for other people, other professions. And we thank you for tuning in. If you're not part of the CJ family, thank you for listening to the shows. And if you are part of the CJ family, welcome back. Thank you. Special thanks again to all those first responders out there protecting us day in and day out. Thank you for your continued service, or maybe you served before and you're a veteran. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be partnered with Four Sigmatic. I cannot tout this company enough. I love their products. I love their cocos, elixirs, their mushroom coffee. If you head over to cjevolution.com, you're going to see a link to Four Sigmatic, and you will get 15% off of all your purchases using the promo code CJEVO. And some of you might be thinking, how did Patrick start his podcast? Who does he use to push out his shows? I use Podbeam, and they can help you if you're a budding or aspiring podcaster. So you can see the link again on the CJ Evolution website, and they can help you get your podcast started. I am so excited to have my next guest on. He is an international speaker. He is an expert in law enforcement, and at one time, he was the head of global operations for the DEA. Enjoy the next guest. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I am super excited to have James L. Capra on the show. If you don't know who he is, he's currently the CEO and founder of Frontline Leadership Group. He has a history, a very distinguished and honorable history in law enforcement at the federal level. He also has a great military background. I am so excited to have him on the show. James, welcome, sir.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. Really do. I'm honored to be on it.
Well, I appreciate you being here. I know you're a very busy man. I gave a little bit of a bio of you. Can you fill in the gap, sir?
Yeah, you know, I was just telling the story the other day. You know, I'm one of those guys that barely got out of high school 100 years ago, and I mean that sincerely. I tried community college for a while. Anyway, I got out, joined the military, and kind of found my way and fell in love with the structure. And my dad was a New York City police officer and retired earlier and because he got hurt. But anyway, the long and short of it is I love this whole the service life, and got out, went to school, and found out that I wasn't as dumb as I thought I was. and was fortunate enough to marry my bride, met her the first day of college, and asked her to marry me 3 months later. So I tell people that's not the normal thing to do, but we've been married for 35 years and known each other for 37. So, you know, she's hung out with me. But when I was done with school, I was first in the Navy and stayed in the Navy Reserves, and then switched over as an air crew off C-130 for the Air National Guard. And then really wanted to fly was what I wanted to do with the military, and really wanted to be in law enforcement. And switched over when I switched colleges. The Army just went, their aviation just went full branch. So mm-hmm. I jumped into an Army ROTC unit and really, really enjoyed it. I had been enlisted already for 6 years. So, and about a month before I got commissioned, they found that I had a bad eye. So I became an intelligence officer. And I was an intelligence officer for a combat aviation battalion. And then in 87, I got hired by DEA. And And for a regular guy, I've had an incredible blessed career. Mm-hmm. Started as a, you know, just an agent, and was fortunate and blessed to move up the ranks and retired ultimately about in 2014 as the chief of global operations. And mm-hmm. just have worked with some amazing men and women, both not just in my agency, but, you know, we have that rivalry amongst a lot of narcotics. Sure. I have to be honest with you. I've been stationed all over the country and traveling around the world, and I'm one of those guys that said, if you got a badge and you're working narcotics and you want to put bad guys in jail, let's go. And yeah. So we've been incredibly blessed to have, you know, some of the best training that I got was from a sergeant from, of all places, Huntington Park, California, who was like a big brother to me. I lost him years ago to colon cancer, but
oh, geez.
Patrolled 2.2 square mile little city. but he taught me more about narcotics and writing search warrants than any school or anything else. And to this day, my kids still refer to him as Uncle Bill. But mm-hmm. yeah, we just have worked in task forces my entire career, and I just had a great time. Mm-hmm. Serving in that capacity. Yeah. After the first Gulf War, matter of fact, I stayed in the reserves in the Army until after the first Gulf War, and I just couldn't juggle. You know, the higher up you go, whether the higher you're enlisted or higher as an officer, the more they want you to, you know, the more they want you to go to advanced training and everything else. And to be honest with you, I tell guys all the time, it was tough to juggle two careers. So yeah. I marvel at the men and women who still serve in reserve and guard capacity, who are constantly being, you know, constantly going overseas and amazing. I just, you know, amazing. And the height of the war, as a matter of fact, you know, 50% of our war fighters came from our Guard and Reserve. So the days of, remember years ago, they used to say, oh, you're a weekend warrior. Those days are long gone.
They're gone.
So anyway, so that's a little bit of snippet about me.
Well, I thank you. I'm sure you get this a lot, sir, but I'm going to reiterate. Thank you so much for your service to the nation, in your military service, and in your law enforcement experience. And, you know, yeah, it's heroes like you that really, I mean, I talk about this in my podcast a lot. I mean, without people like you, James, we wouldn't have this country that we have. And I sincerely mean that.
I'm in a good group of men and women. And I often say, you know, hey, Mike, you know, compared to, I think, my sons today, I served a lot during peacetime when the first Gulf War hit, if you remember, I got called up and they said, hey, we see you didn't volunteer. I was already on DEA. I said, I'll volunteer. I'll never forget Sergeant Major saying to me, he's not, it's going to be over with pretty quick.
Yeah.
We just want to know. But I, you know, I have sons that have served. My oldest son is served at 3 combat tours as a Marine officer in Afghanistan. And so I'm proud of them. And I tell people all the time, but guys like me who haven't had to go to combat from the military, I've talked to a lot of guys. You know, I really feel bad when people say that. I said, don't. You would have. If you got called up, you would have gone.
And yeah.
Not everybody raises their hand. We have an all-volunteer service
exactly.
to do these jobs. So just being in it, you know, serving your country and being prepared to go. So it means it's a great deal. And my entire family, I grew up with six. You know, there were 6 boys and 1 girl, and with the exception of one brother, every one of us has served. Our sons are serving, and not to have to be dour on the podcast or anything, but you know, we also understand the sacrifice. My brother, who's a retired Air Force colonel, he's got 12 kids, all from one wife.
Wow, 12 kids.
Yeah, most of his sons have served, but we lost his oldest. He was an Air Force EOD guy in Iraq. Ago, almost 10 years ago. Oh, so we understand the sacrifice that comes with it as well. So it just does. I mean, it's part of it. Nobody likes it. You know, it's like being on a job when we lose a brother or sister on the job. Nobody likes it. It's never fair, you know, no matter what. It just it stinks. But it's something that comes with our job.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into your books because I know you have a bunch of books out there. 3, right, sir?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. And I want to talk about that, but I want to, you know, I want to talk a little bit because you're an expert in leadership, and why is leadership so important in law enforcement these days?
You know,
it's always been important, but
yeah, it is. But you know, about 15, 16 years ago, I mean, I've run into some really great leaders in DEA, and I've run into a lot of poor leaders, and you constantly ask yourself, why is that? You know, why do men and women, you know, get into these positions? And quite honestly, they're buttheads. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it about that? You know, is it something they got to learn? Is it personality? And I'll tell you at the heart of the matter and why it's important. Not just because of our profession, not just because of the stress that our men and women have to move into each day. I tell them they go into the arena every day. And most of our men and women are technically competent. You know what I mean? They know how to do the job.
Yeah.
And I always say, but we know how to do a job, we're trained to do it, and I tell people, but do you know why you do it? You know, and I tell the leaders the same thing. So about 18 years ago or so, I just took it upon myself. I had moved up some ranks, and I would ask young men and women about why. They'd say, hey, I want to be a first line. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's awesome. And you go, why? And you kind of get that, look in your face like, oh, well, what's, is this a test? But no, but, you know, why do you want to do it? What's it about? You know, it's okay if you want a couple extra bucks. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
It's okay that you want the next challenge. But you got to really ask yourself, I mean, really want to, you know, is it suddenly there are some people that move into positions, really, as low as a first line, as high as I've seen as executives, and they suddenly seem to think that they're taller, smarter, and better looking than everybody else. Leadership. And I tell people all the time, be careful about your ego.
Yeah.
In the height of my first tour in D.C., I think this is really where I really started getting disappointing in the, across the board with running into a lot of people in the Beltway. My brother, who I told you was a retired lieutenant colonel and was working now works for the director of national intelligence. Anyway, we very rarely commuted together, but for some reason we did. And I remember being so annoyed because I was coming from a number of meetings in the Beltway. And I remember looking at him and saying, do you have to be, and I got a little graphic that I won't hear on your show, but I said, you have to be a butthead to be a leader in this,
yeah,
in this town. I mean, I was really pissed, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody I seemed to work, whether they were at two stars or whether they were undersecretary or they were, you know, a director at some agency, they're pompous, a lot of these guys. And I said, yeah, it's hard to find somebody with some humility. And I'll never forget my brother Tony looking at me and saying, he said, hey, bro, you know what happens is people forget to bring their heart to work.
Yeah.
I grabbed onto that and went, boom, that's it. Yeah. That's exactly right. And so you asked me, is it important to be a leader at work, but you got to be the same kind of leader at home.
Exactly.
And so what's in your heart? See, the idea, honestly, brother, is I tell people from the moment they step into that position, it's never about you. Mm-hmm. And the problem is sometimes we have men and women who suddenly, because they got some stripes or, a, you know, they got a star or they got a, you know, a butter bar or a gold bar, whatever it is that they're going to, and they suddenly think that it's about me. It's not, that's not the way it goes, man. It's, yeah, it's about, and servant leadership's got a bad name to it. You know, it just does. People think, you know, it's dandelions in your hair and everybody gets a hug. It's not, man.
I'm a big subscriber of servant leadership, and I think it's very important, especially these days in law enforcement.
Yeah. So the desire. So what, you know, tell people, well, what do you, when you say that, Jimmy, what do you mean by that? I said, here's what I mean by it. Your desire is for the men and women who are, listen to me, they're entrusted to you. And people go, what do you mean? They are entrusted to you as a leader, and your job is to help them, right, to help them to pursue excellence both professionally and personally. Mm-hmm. You want them to grow both, yeah, on both sides.
Yeah.
You know, there's, that's what you want to do, because you're going to, you know, that's what, where your heart should be.
Yeah.
And by the way, everything is bathed in accountability. It's not like everybody gets a hug, because even in doing that, you there are times you got to look at somebody and say, you're fired. You got to go. Mm-hmm. I love you. But you got to go.
Yeah.
So,
and I always said, and I'm sure you've heard this before, Jimmy, but I don't want to be the smartest guy in the room. I want to surround myself with people who are smarter than me. I might have a certain rank or a title, but that doesn't mean I know everything. I want to be surrounded by people who help me grow. And I also want to be the one who helps people, you know, I help coach and mentor people to take my job someday. That's where the humility comes in.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's what you're right. I think we learn that after a while as we move up. I think we're smart about it. I remember as a first line supervisor, I remember right before I was in California for almost 9 years, mm-hmm, started in Manhattan, was in Little Manhattan for a short time, and went to California. And I remember it was time to test. And I tell people all the time, man, I was hungry to become a supervisor, mm-hmm, because people poured into my life. I was good at my job. I was technically competent at my job. And I was really looking for that challenge for the next step. And in my mind, you know, I always equate our job. My kids have had to grow up with this. That's why four public service and three of them became cops. But I said, listen, man, we are in a league with Captain America. Don't, mm-hmm, you understand that? We're in a league with Captain America. And so I said, I can't wait to take over my, you know, the next group. And here's in my mind, man, this is this young mentality that I had. I knew I was good at it, but I would say, they're going to love me, I'm going to love them, and we're going to storm the gates of hell. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, my buddy Ron DeLeese, never forget it, man. He's been retired for a while. But he was my supervisor. And he said, Capra, he goes, you know what your biggest problem is? And I'm thinking, my problem? I got no problem. I'm Jimmy freaking Capra. I don't have a problem. These guys, it's going to be awesome. And then I forget, he told me, he goes, you think everybody thinks like you do? And I'm like, well, of course we do. We're DEA. Mm-hmm. And what a shock it was to suddenly see people as individuals when you're in a leadership position. Mm-hmm. See, not everybody does feel about the job the way I do. No, not everybody is at the same level. So it's a learning process. Mm-hmm. But it still doesn't mean, it still doesn't mean that your job, part of your job, should be, to build people. I call it pour into them. The thing that you realize is as you're pouring into some people, you can walk away and hear it leaking, and it's leaking out their butt. Mm-hmm. And then what do you do?
How do you empower people, James? I mean, you were in charge of global operations for the DEA, in charge of thousands of agents. So, and I'm sure you had some people that were easier than others to empower. But how do you empower people to lead and to make good decision. Now, granted, people are going to make mistakes. We all get that. But how do you give that to people?
Well, let me start with this is my personal. I don't have, five magic steps. I tell people all the time, or the 12 principles, or anything else like that. But I have this moniker that I used to say. I talk about people. I talk about purpose, and I talk about passion. And this is what I usually start off when I speak to people about. I go, we deal with people every single day. They come from all walks of life. They have all different faiths. It's one of the most, in the law enforcement community, one of the most diverse communities, diverse profession that's out there. And each one of those people have a purpose. I said they have a purpose in the organization, just like the organization does, but they also have a moral purpose in life. Mm-hmm. And good leaders will want to lead them with a relative amount of passion. Mm-hmm. to move them. In other words, you should be able to take those people to that level where they can't get to by themselves. And you say, how do you empower them? Well, I start by telling men and women who are first line, says, you've got to get to know your people personally, mm-hmm. professionally. You've got to be willing to get them. And that takes time to do. And then you constantly, this is constant message for me throughout my whole career, was to pursue excellence in everything that we did. It's not about success, I would tell people, is you want to pursue excellence in everything you do. You said something interesting earlier, so I want to surround myself. I'm not the smartest guy in the room. Believe me, if you grew up with me, I've always known that. But you want to be able to leverage those men and women mm-hmm. who are those smart, who really, really do have it together. Mm-hmm. And so you empower people by talking to them, talk life into them. You want to, and the other thing is, my biggest thing is, you want to be able to get a hold of their hearts.
Yeah, lead from the heart.
Yeah, you really want to get a hold of their hearts and say, hey, and really, I used to, so I did this all the way up through my career, and then people like you have asked me, well, you're the chief global operations, and you talk about leading from the heart, talk about caring about people, but you had all, you talk about getting to know these people. And I had a guy ask me, well, do you know the guy who's, stationed in South America? And I want to punch him in the throat because he's going, you should go to know everybody. So listen, and that message I drove down to everybody that I was responsible mm-hmm. for, especially my command staff. I'd say, this is what we're, about every 3 months, so picture this, every morning at 8 o'clock in DEA headquarters, when I was chief of operations, we'd have operations meetings Monday through Friday. Doesn't matter. Critical incidents, you're down there all of them. So, and you're surrounded by these men and women that are just amazing. Their own careers. I've had a wonderful career and a great career, but you're surrounded by these men and women that you almost think, man, my walk pales into comparison.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They're amazing. But here's what I purposely did. So intentionality is so important. And when you're leading from the heart, you can't fake it. You got to be willing to be vulnerable about things. And there's a lot of guys and gals that don't want to be vulnerable. But I would stop a minute, and I'd say this group of amazing executives, and I would say something like this. I said, don't ever forget who we are. Mm-hmm. Don't ever forget what our purpose is here, our organization. Don't ever forget that how important it is to make sure that we care about not only about the men and women that are entrusted to us, but there are people outside this building who are praying that their families are safe, and praying that some of them praying that their kids are not going to get involved in dope, and some of them are praying that the law enforcement officers will arrest their kid because they'd rather have them in jail than dead on the street.
Sure.
So, the answer to that prayer, our pursuit should be for excellence in everything we do, not success, because quite honestly, you can cheat and succeed, you can lie and succeed. And so the drive for excellence means you're not content with where you are, both from a professional standpoint and a personal standpoint. I don't mean content in your salary, content in your position in life as far as your family. I'm talking about content is how can we drive this thing mm-hmm. to the next level? What can I learn? And you never get there. The thing about this whole leadership gig is, you know, it's like, it's not like Maslow's thing. Someday you're self-actualized.
Oh, no. It's a constant process.
Constant, man. And you got to be willing to be teachable. And the other thing is, I've done this all the time. You look back and go, if I had to assess myself, I probably I was too hard on this one. I was too strong on this. I should have spent a little bit more time in this office, especially when you have remote offices that you have to try to visit with. And I think that's good to be critical about that, not to a point where it hinders you. But it's really about messaging your men and women from a heart position that you mm-hmm. care. And people, you know, I've been asked this before. Well, I don't get it. You know, you talk about loving people and caring about getting to know them, and suddenly they turn into great people. I go, no, that doesn't happen all the time. But I'll tell you, people respond well, super well, when they know they're cared for. When they're genuinely cared for, people get that. And they see through the – in our profession, brother.
Oh, yeah.
They live – they're home to see through BS.
And that fosters trust, which is so important in leadership positions, because if you are leading from the heart, servant leadership, which I really believe in, you're going to gain that trust, which is so important in leadership positions. You know that, Jimmy. I mean, you have to have that trust. And it's not that they're not going to naysay things that you do and have questions about that, but trust is so important in leadership.
Well, it's funny you said that, because I have a whole thing on I talk about, you know, resurrecting trust in organizations. And it's about, so how do you do that? So you have to develop relationships.
Of course.
You develop relationships with men and women. You talk to them about things. And I have this other thing is, what don't we have time for? And the problem is as not just as we move up through the ranks, but even sometimes, you know, at the basic levels that wherever you're at in law enforcement, we can think that we're too busy I'm too busy for this, or I'm too busy.
Your human capital is more important than that.
Yeah, and then you stop and you're going to go, man, suddenly I'm too busy for my family. Suddenly I'm too busy for that guy or girl. Suddenly I'm no longer noticing certain things, cues that are out there that if I'm not paying attention to, that somebody's hurting, not only at work, but in your home life. And so the idea, you said it, man, I talk about the whole key about leadership is building relationships of trust. And I called it what we once knew it by, which was covenant relationships, which means if you and I were standing side by side with each other, I'd lock arms with you. And this is not a goofy thing. It's just from a metaphor thing. Yeah. It's just like, I'm going to pour into you. You're going to pour into me. I'm going to take responsibility for my actions with you and vice versa. You know, but today everything is done by contract. And some of that is because of litigation in the world that we live in today. But we forgot about how important, you know, developing these kinds of relationships are, even from an organizational standpoint. A quick story. I know I have a lot of words because that's what I do for a living. When I was running the office here in Dallas, one of the most amazing things is to work with our FBI counterparts, Secret Service, ATF, IRS. We get to know the leaders in those organizations. And I would tell my ASACs and my GSs, you get to know those men and women so that we develop the kind of relationship where you can call them up and get stuff done and they can partner with you. I've been around all around the country. I've been stationed in a lot of different places. And I will tell you, those kind of relationships, when you develop those kind of covenant relationships with people, it is better than gold, man. Mm-hmm. It's just better than gold. These are, you know, these men and women who I got to know as executives, they come over to your house. We got to know their wives. And so it's not that there's never going to be an issue when you're dealing, especially with type A's and aggressive guys, law enforcement and in narcotics, you're going to have that. But it was mitigated at the lowest level, which was great. But more importantly, there was this incredible sense that we're going to get this stuff done and we're going to get it done, you know, collectively. Mm-hmm. Even when, I'd call guys that was outside of our, you know, normal what would be our purview for work, especially if Secret Service would hit something for whatever it is and you'd hear about it and they're running, you'd call them up, what do you need? What can we help you with? You know, something as like when the Super Bowl was here, you know, that, hey, you need more bodies because we can get from the Department of Justice to cover that. You know, that's the kind of, that's what you want to do. So now you, so now you've got this relationship with your men and women at work, then you've got these external relationships with these organizations. And I used to, and I tell people all the time, people should look at that, man, and say, that's what good government looks like. Mm-hmm. That's what good servants look like. That's, you know what I mean? That's the kind of thing to be prideful about. Not about, hey, I'm going to retire someday and they're going to name a building after me. What are you going to leave in the hearts and the minds of men and women that were entrusted to you?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the key.
And the one thing I really love, I mean, I saw a video of you, Jimmy, about how, you know, God bless your wife. I mean, she's been through a lot with you being gone for so many weeks, you know, weeks at a time. How do you maintain, you know, especially somebody in your position who is in charge of global operations, you're in charge of all, you're gone all the time, and cops who are listening and law enforcement are listening can probably relate to this. You're, you have long shifts, you're working weird hours. How do you maintain that work-life balance, especially in what we do?
Yeah, I it's funny because I just was, we were talking to somebody last night about this issue about balance, and I have found that when men and women love their careers and they love their professions and they believe, like I have done, and many so often, that this was my calling. I stand up and tell people this was my calling in my life, my first phase of my life. This was my calling. I'm in a new calling now, and so it's hard to be balanced when you have that kind of drive in you. But what happens after a while if you're not careful, and I speak from experience, is you, what happens after a while is you start to lose your way, your moorings, and what happens is you start to become what becomes more important to you is what's happening at work, or maybe the promotion, or what's happening.
What are you missing?
And as I say, is you suddenly can be this great leader at work, this amazing guy that, you know, has his guys and gals rocking and rolling, and then you're losing your family. You know, you're losing your way with your family. And so I that's a part of some of the things that I talk about and speak about. And I don't teach. I tell people I don't teach because it's just – it's you're sharing with – we share with what guys and gals already know is true. We know that it's true. We know it. And so I say some hard things sometimes. I say, listen, don't divorce happens and everything. What I tell guys is, don't tell me the job got you a divorce. What happens is we make decisions.
Exactly.
And we blame something else on it. And so the idea is, how do we mitigate that? And that takes, especially from guys like us and others who are driven, or who are driven and purposeful and intentional, to take a breath and go, wait a minute, what are my priorities? Because this is temporary. This gig that we have is very, very temporary. So in pursuing my profession, I'm not going to – it took me a great lesson to say I'm not going to lose my family. Listen, one of my first headquarters tours went from working 12 hours a day. I got promoted, working 13 hours a day, got promoted as an executive, and it went to 14, 16, to 18, to sometimes 20 hours a day. That is just absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. We just believed that was work. And had it not been for my wife one night coming home late at night saying, hey, man, you know, I'm worried about you. Your kids are worried about you. And by the way, you're aging in front of us. It kind of shook me to my bones. And I knew she was right.
Yeah.
I knew she was right. And I had to go in and go, hey, this is what I'm not doing anymore. And it created a little bit of division between me, and I was already executive, with a boss of mine who was an executive. You know,
it was the right thing to do.
I still had young kids. He had, all his kids were out. And so he lived, ate, and breathed the job. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm. Start to go, I'm not going to lose my family because of this. It's not going to do it. And you come to a point sometimes where you just got to go, hey, man. And I ask guys, what's your priority? Mm-hmm. You know, job is great, but you know, what's your and that's what you have to come to. You said, how do you do that? It's you just don't do it once. It's this constant thing to say, you know what? We've all missed birthdays, right? I'm sure if you've worked in our profession, we've missed birthdays, we've missed anniversaries.
Sure.
But when it comes to be habitual, you have to stop and go, wait a minute, hang on a second.
Yeah.
Now, let me come up for air.
Yeah. Can you talk about some? You got three books out there, Jimmy.
Yeah.
And one of the latest is Leading from the Heart at the Frontline. I love that title. I mean, I haven't read it. I want to read it.
That was actually the first one.
Oh, so the first one.
So
can you talk about your books?
Yeah, 20 years ago, I used to say, I want to write a book someday. I had no idea what I was going to write about. And I said it jokingly. But when I got into this whole thing about sharing with our men and women about the heart of leading and caring about people. And so here's this big guy talking to these groups and telling you got to learn how to love people. And exactly. And that, you know, for people in our profession, sometimes it can take them back. So what are you talking about, bro? You talk about everybody gets hugged.
You're not tough, dude. You're the head of global operations. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about putting aside your political ideology, your faith ideology, and caring about those men and women who are entrusted to you. And so for every now and then, I would see something, you know, that maybe, you know, say a guy like you would say something and I would take a pen and write it down. I go, I'm going to remember that. And then it was again, my wife who said, when I was still in my last tour, she says, you know, you always said you're going to write a book. She goes, why don't you on the weekends? And what I did is it's just a snapshot. So I call it Leadership at the Frontline, Lessons Learned About Loving, Leading, and Legacy from a Warrior and Public Servant. And that's exactly what it is. It's the things that I learned, the good, the bad, the ugly, of being a supervisor and an executive and moving up the ranks, talking about my family as well and the challenges that we had, but the fun parts about it. Some of it is humorous. A lot of it is just storytelling about the things that I've learned about men and women and what it takes to really to care about people. And, mm-hmm. and the whole premise of the book is just this snapshot of saying, this leadership gig is not rocket science. Yeah. It's about a heart thing and about caring about people. And the other, it's about relationships.
Exactly.
It's also about not losing your way at home and keeping your...
See, and this is the thing that I really wish, James, that they would teach more in the academy. I'm not saying you have to spend, you know, a whole semester on it or whatever on the academy, but I really wish that they would teach more about emotional wellness and relationships. Yep. I mean, yeah. I understand it's a tight curriculum and they have to get so much in, and it's probably like that in the DA, and you got training and stuff. But this is the stuff that really matters. It's the relationships. It's leading from the heart, like you said, and what's important. Yeah. Not that the job's not important. I'm not saying that. But you got to have that. What your family is important. You got to have that. You know what's more important in life. You know what I mean?
And so that's it. What you said is that needs to come from to when guys get to the command, whatever command they're at, and for the leadership to say, this is great. You got to be, like I used to tell my guys, you have to mentally, physically, and spiritually prepare to fight and win.
Exactly.
I'm going to tell you that right now. That's what we want. But as you're moving along, is to remind those guys. And the guys who don't have families, hey, listen, this is going to be here tomorrow. I expect 100% of this whole idea. I used to, you know, it took me a while when people said, I want 200% for my people. I said, this is ridiculous. Why are you these people going to, I said, you know, you have a machine, some of our machines can run at 150%, 200% for a short period of time, and then they'll burn out.
Yeah, exactly.
And the human body will do the same thing. So stop being unrealistic with our men and women.
Yeah.
You know, stop telling them that, you know. Yeah. They want to be there, they want to do their jobs, but they got to be reminded, hey, you know. And part of that reminder is, I swear to God, man, the whole relationship building, sometimes you just walk up to somebody, and it's when you've got a big command or got a small command, it's hard, but you know, guys come in from work every now and then, just looking at them and say, hey, man, nice work today.
Yeah.
You know, I use an example of this. A chief of operations in one of the groups, the special operations division, did this amazing frigging case out there and just using undercover stuff, and it was just incredible. But they came under the headquarters element, and the administrator, who was I've known for 20 years, she walks in, she goes, listen, I just want to say that was a heck of a job. You did this, that, and the other thing. I'm thinking, I suddenly felt good. Look, I had nothing to do with this thing.
Yeah.
But the human reaction is, wow, that, you know, you're being there's a squeeze, a pat on the back. And, you know, of course, I've been telling the guys at Special Operations how amazingly they were about something. But it doesn't even have to be that. Here's what used to become important to me, especially as an agent in charge and even when I was running ops, is at least at the headquarters level, I used to tell guys, hey, I want to know if we have somebody hurting. I want to know if somebody's having a baby.
So important.
Yeah, and it's hard. Like it's hard to, but, you know, it's just a phone call.
Yeah.
From your sergeant, your first line, your second line, even from your boss saying, hey, man, congratulations. How's your wife doing? How's everything? Or, hey, I heard your kid's sick. What can we do? And I say this because here's it. In everything that we do, brother, there's not a book out there that tells you what to do when you, like me, get a phone call in the middle of the night saying that somebody was robbed and killed in Colombia, or you get a, you come in the next day and say so-and-so's kid was just diagnosed with terminal cancer, or you get it, you come in and says, you know, so-and-so's wife just kicked him out of the house. All those things that happen. So do we not care about it? I said, you can't solve those problems sometimes. But I believe in my heart, our moral responsibility is to be part of that support group. To just and sometimes you want to know something. Some of the only things I could do at times with people, and the older I've gotten, the more mush I've gotten, is go up to somebody, look them in the eyes, hug them, and cry with them for a moment.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that, folks who are listening out there. There's nothing wrong with that.
It's like, you don't, you know, like I said, I'm this big frigging guy that's been around. I tell people I carry a sword my whole career. I've got it. It's an art form for me. And I said, but there's, in that moment, when people are so vulnerable and so hurting, you know, there's nothing like, especially I've been on the receiving end of that, is for somebody to just come up and hug you and say, hey, man, I'm thinking about you. We're praying for you. Just for that moment.
And
just,
as we've been conditioned, you know, from a very young age, you know, especially people in our line of work, Jimmy, you know this, we've been conditioned. You can't show that emotion. You can't. You got to be tough. You got to be hard. You got to be all this other stuff. And there's you have to show that emotion. You have to be caring. You have to. I'm not saying people out there aren't caring that are listening.
No, I'm
just saying that you have to show that emotion. It's perfectly okay to show that human side.
I would tell people all the time that if I had to tell you anything, be willing to be vulnerable.
Exactly.
And with people. And there are a lot of guys that don't want to be vulnerable.
That means a leadership quality right there.
Yeah, that means you'll really get to know me.
Yeah.
And there are some guys and gals that go, I don't want them to get to know me, because if they get to know me, maybe they won't really like me.
Oh, come
maybe
on.
They'll see me as a human being. And I go, yeah, guess what? Yeah. My gig was to tell people a lot about my family. I love talking about kids and my wife and everything. Because, you know, one of the other things it does, it reinforces those priorities within me as well.
Exactly.
I tell guys, I'll tell them, hey, listen, you know, tomorrow, for us, you know, the work that we, you know, our guys and gals, the standard work week is like a 60 to 80 hour work week is what it is. So, you know, you're going to, you know, so a guy comes in and says, hey, I just had a baby. And you go home early, take a couple of days off.
Exactly.
This will be here for you. But I think it's more than that, because I think we sometimes have lost our way. In that, really, what is it to really mean to care about men and women? And so there's this whooshy, kind of mushy stuff on one side, but on the other side, it's really about this, everything we do is bathed in accountability. And that the other thing is that we want our men and women to grow professionally and personally.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that they're going to be, you know, they're going to be chiefs someday. There are a lot of guys out there that love being just an agent. A lot of guys just love being on patrol. But that doesn't mean they can't grow professionally.
Exactly.
They can't grow personally, and I'm just a big believer in that, man. I'm just an absolute believer about really, really care. And you can't fake that stuff.
No,
man.
You can't. And like we talked about before, I mean, it builds trust. It lets people know that you care about them, because that's what they're truly about. I mean, you know, we're so good, James. You know this. We're so good at solving other people's problems in law enforcement. We can go out there, we can, you know, solve the whatever call we get. I don't care if it's a state, federal, whatever. We're so good at solving problems, other people's problems. But so many times we struggle with our own problems, you know, and relationships, and whether it's home or personal. And that's the thing that's always baffled me. I know you've been doing this a lot longer than I have, but you know, I've always wondered that. Why is it so hard? Not for everybody, but some officers, it's so hard to deal with our own demons and our own problems when it's so easy to go out there and deal with others.
You know, it's funny you said that. One of the things I used to tell our men and women all the time, all the way up to executives, I'd say, hey, listen, you really should find somebody. Find either a mentor or a mentee, I would say. Find somebody who's got a little bit more time on that you trust and say that you can go to them without anything and say, hey, have you ever had to deal with this? Hey, have you ever had to deal with that? And I tell guys all the time, find somebody that you can go to. And I remember from my earlier days up to, you know, when I was an executive, you find somebody that you can call up. I would call them like accountability brothers. You get what I
mean? I love it.
Can I run something by you, man? Hey, I'm dealing with it. Not something that somebody's going to let his guard down and say, hey. When new guys would promote, no matter what rank I was at, you try to get a hold of me and say, if there's anything I can do to help you with, if there's anything at all. And you're right. And then some of the guys are, hey, no problem, man. It's not a problem. I know. But you're going to run into something that's not written in any friggin' book.
Exactly.
So I can help you with that. Yeah. There's something I can do. Or if you just – listen, the other thing is if you just need to vent, scream and yell, and I'll listen, man. I'll just sit here and listen. I'm not Dr. Phil, but I know it's at the end of your wits. You got family issues, you got work issues, and if you just need to scream and yell, and I've been very, very blessed to have a handful of guys, even to this day, I call them accountability guys, that I've done that with. I can pick up the phone and I can let loose. The other thing is I could do is, hey, man, have you ever run into something like this?
Yeah.
So then that makes you better, man.
It's just amazing stuff. Sir, if people want to reach out to you and read your books, how can they find you?
Yeah, well, I'm easy. I have a website. You got to get around all the anti-marijuana guys that hate me. So we did three, but the first book is Leadership at the Frontline. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's on Amazon. Our second book is called The Eagle and the Seagulls, and it's we call it a wisdom story for children and adults, and it's actually a story I made up for my kids over 30-something years ago about how to deal with the storms in your life. Funny that I have a brother-in-law who actually pastors a church out in New York, and he used it for an adult education class, and I was just so – I was profoundly thankful he was telling me about it, because the principle is the same. When you run into heavy things in life, what are the things that keep you grounded? The third book was born out of my middle son is a police officer as well. Mm-hmm. And he, a couple of years ago, came up to me and he said, Dad, what the hell is wrong with my generation? Mm-hmm. And he was saying it rhetorically. And so we were talking about I tell people all the time, I'm not the ultimate, my wife and I will tell you both, we're not perfect parents or anything, but
nobody is, James.
No, but what happened? So when we wrote this third book called "Raising Courageous Children in a Cowardly Culture," and it's the battle for their hearts and minds. And so my wife and I sat and wrote our story and our journey of both the joys and the challenges of raising kids in sometimes a culture that's kind of void of moral absolutes. And it's not a how-to book. I tell people because I threaten to pull body parts off my kids when they were younger. It's not helpful, but it's funny, and we ask permission from our kids. Some of them had a little bit more adversity than others, and how we reacted to it, the mistakes that I made as a dad, you know, in terms of. But the neat things that we learned is doing really, really well, and really well in terms of we're now being asked to go to conferences. But you said so you can get online, you can go to our website, which is frontlineleadershipgroup.com. You can go on Amazon and look for, you know, you can run my name, James Capper, or my wife, Shelley Capper, and the books will come up. My phone number is in there. I tell people all the time I'm easy to find. It's on the website, 214-837-0231. And I make my living now, travel around the country talking about leadership issues, some family issues. I still get dragged into, bro, talking about the whole legalization movement, which is frustrating as heck. It's just been a great, I'll tell you, this is the new season we're in, and we're excited as heck about it.
Well, sir, I thank you so much. I know you're a very busy individual, and thank you for your service. Again,
same thing.
In law enforcement and the military, you are a true American hero. I will have all your information linked up in the show notes. We wish you much success in the future, sir, and you're always welcome back on the show.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it. It's an honor to be with you, man. It really is.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.